This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
Tonight I want to kind of flip this from another angle. If last week was about imagining how we sort of move away from gender as a relevant category in many areas of Jewish practice, I want tonight to tread into perhaps the slightly more difficult and sometimes controversial question of where are the places where gender remains sticky in the sense of it remains a kind of a factor, or places where biology or gender difference potentially matter, and how to think about the question of what I've called here egalitarianism and androgyny, and whether they inexorably go together or not. So let me define those terms. What I mean by egalitarianism is the equality between the sexes or the genders. Okay, the equality, the equal treatment, that each one is treated the same in no hierarchical fashion compared to the other. What I mean by androgyny is the notion that gender is simply not a factor at all. This is what I will refer to throughout this evening's discussion as the difference between gender equal and gender blind. All right, and let's just clarify what that means. When we think about suffrage, the right to vote, there's not just gender equality in suffrage in the United States and most countries, or in Israel. There is also gender blindness. That is to say, the question of one's gender has nothing to do whatsoever with entering into the voting booth. By contrast, still in many contexts, though this is changing in our own time, the notion of a public bathroom is a space where there is a principled commitment to equality, though the women will often tell you there's not actually the correct allotment of space, but that's a separate issue. There is a commitment to equality of access to the same resource, but there is not gender blindness to the extent that there is a sign on a bathroom door that differentiates based on one's gender, one's biology, of who can go in. And in that sense, what we need to sort of recognize, and what I want to kind of push tonight, is the clear theoretical possibility. We're going to get to the practical issues in a minute. The clear theoretical possibility of being committed to gender equality without gender blindness. The two certainly can go together. One can even claim that they ought to go together, but theoretically they're not the same. The question of being committed to egalitarianism does not logically bind one to a commitment to what I'm referring to tonight as androgyny. Or at least that's the question that I want to put on the table tonight, whether the only way to achieve full gender equality is to embrace androgyny. It is true that for the most part in Jewish life, we see a full correlation between the two. That is to say, I can think of one, maybe two minyanim, maybe you could give me an example of a few others, where there is separate seating based on gender, but complete and full equality with respect to who counts in a minyan and who can perform which rituals for who. Put another way, if you came to me and said, I'm just looking for a place to pray where, irrespective of gender, anyone can blow shofar and anyone counts as one of the 10 of the minyan, I would most likely have to direct you to a place with mixed seating, even though you did not ask me about that. You asked me about questions of citizenship and power, but for the most part in our world, there's a near-perfect overlap between full gender equality in Jewish ritual spaces and a gender blindness where gender is not taken into account, even though we obviously live in a moment where that is being experimented with and broken down in all kinds of ways. And that's exactly why I want to talk about this issue tonight. Must that correlation be so, and should it be so? So here's the conundrum as I see it. separation between any two groups, we're going to be focusing on gender, but separation between any two groups against a backdrop of inequality only reinforces hierarchies of power and exclusion. Right, that's the lesson of segregation in the United States. It's the lesson of the struggle to integrate Arab citizens into the state of Israel. A formal proclamation of emancipation and equal rights does not produce equality on the ground. And then, when you proceed with segregation in that environment, you virtually guarantee ongoing marginalization and exclusion, less investment in the less powerful population, and the use of authority and power to favor one group over the other, even if it's only unintentional and subliminal. And therefore, to a certain degree, separation in a world of inequality is only justifiable if you are prepared to perpetuate that inequality. If you enforce gender separation in contexts where men are central and women are peripheral, then the separation itself reinforces that hierarchy. A clear example of this was from a few years ago in Beit Shemesh, where a sign went up on the street, many remember this story, that asked women to cross to the other side of the street so that they would not linger in front of the synagogue. Okay, now, that was actually an interesting example in the sense of one might say that the motivation behind that sign was a perfectly fine and understandable motivation, which was the feeling that it was inappropriate for men and women to be mixing on the street, which one could imagine as being a theoretically completely equally applied concern to men and to women. But because all sorts of reasons why it wasn't, but among the factors in this case, because the Beit Knesset was quite clearly understood to be the domain primarily of men, even though women might also attend it, a decree around gender separation near the synagogue did not just mean people were separating, but it meant women were being asked to cross the street. Right? And that's always the way it works when there's separation against the backdrop of inequality. And all of that means that those who are in favor of gender equality have to cultivate a healthy suspicion of divisions by gender. But, on the other hand, there is no question that the specter of a loss of difference and a threat of homogenization of identity creates resistance towards equality. For a significant number of Jews, and I think it's a meaningful number of ritually observant Jews, the looming fear of androgyny is precisely one of the barriers to accepting gender equality. The fear that by signing on to gender equality, what I'm signing on to is the erasure of male and female, is precisely one of the things that gets in the way. And for many, I think it's fair to say, if the ticket to a world of gender equality is purchased through gender blindness, they will not pay the admission fee. And this then hampers the broad advancement of equality in a practical sense, if such equality only comes in forms that eliminate that difference. Now, sometimes that kind of resistance to integration and the sort of preservation of difference is just a vestigial form of discrimination. Right? That's what the 13th Amendment to the United States Constitution calls a badge and incidence of slavery. Things that are sort of remnants of an earlier regime of inequality now being passed off as about accommodating a certain way of life, a certain preference for how things ought to be set up. That is certainly largely how we now think about race, where the consensus is that race is not something real, or it's at least not something essential that should drive laws and policies and practice in any meaningful way. But not all kinds of difference are equally either anchored in or unmoored from reality. There are some kinds of difference that are arguably more essential than others, right? Hand dominance is real. It's an intrinsic trait that can't be fundamentally quashed or altered. And if you ignore that difference across the population, it leads not only to inefficiency, but potentially to hazards in work environments and all sorts of other complications. And in that sense, I think a lot of our discussion around how to think about gender equality and gender blindness actually boils down to how relevant biological sex differences ought to be and ought to shape gender roles in various social contexts. There's no question that there's an unmistakable trend in many quarters today to treat gender like race, as an entirely constructed and malleable category that ought to be eliminated as a consideration in anything having to do with public policy and religious practice. That's been a clear trend in American legal contexts. Even in areas where things were taken for granted, like public bathrooms, there's a reevaluation of that now, and a question of when should laws that discriminate based on gender be allowed to stand. It is still the case, interestingly, that race and gender are not treated the same, at least in American law. Race is subject to strict scrutiny, which means it's presumed to be unconstitutional to say blacks have to be treated this way and whites have to be treated that way, unless you have a really overriding, compelling state interest that cannot be accomplished in any other way. Whereas gender has what has been articulated from the bench as an intermediate standard of scrutiny, some acknowledgement that, well, there might be something a little more real and essential going on there, but we should still be suspicious. Now, you can definitely claim, be on the side of those who will say there's really virtually no remaining foundation, whether it's in biology or in social roles, for arranging almost anything according to gender. And if you feel that way, then it's clear that divisions based on gender can only serve to reinforce gender hierarchies, and then you will have to shun them and resist them. But I want to offer a substantive and tactical rejoinder to that way of thinking. That is to say, that it is so obvious that this category and the notion of difference in this area should be wiped off the map. First of all, substantively, it doesn't seem true to me. This is an area where I actually feel I have kind of grown and my thinking has developed over the years. I think if you had asked me 10, 15 years ago, I would have said that our world was inexorably progressing towards increased androgyny on all fronts, and that those resisting that were just having a tough time adjusting to the new reality. And there is some truth to that progression in that direction, but I also think, and I've come to really experience through many conversations with colleagues, students, that there is tremendous variety in this regard. As the Mishnah says, Ein echad domeh l'chaveiro, and some experience the function of gender and the presence of sexual energies in the world very different from others. That's borne out by our tradition. There's various statements, kol ha-gadol me-chaveiro, yitzro gadol he-menu. Different people have different ways of interacting with issues of sex and gender in the world. And I think close attention to human experience bears it out as well. And I don't think, though it's often tempting to hide behind this, that this is a denominational issue. I think instead that it is something that simply affects different people differently. And to the extent that the Torah and its mitzvot are meant to respond to the realities of life, substantively, I think it's wrong to ignore that data and subdue it completely to an abstract paradigm. That's a substantive point. Tactically, I think it's always important to remember that there are winning and losing issues. We're on the eve of an election right now, right? I don't mean to say that there's kind of winning issues are right and losing issues are wrong, but there are certain formulations that are simply inherently at a disadvantage in the public political discourse, such that even those who advocate for them have to adopt a defensive posture in order to argue for them. So, for instance, in the United States, raising taxes is a losing issue. You can think it's right to raise taxes, but you will ultimately recast it as an investment in the future, a way in which we have to build things that are important to society. The rhetoric, the framing of raising taxes is a losing issue. Again, doesn't mean you won't vote for it. Doesn't mean you think it's not the right thing, but you're on the defensive. Advocating open borders without enforcement, that's a losing issue. Right? You can be in favor of that. That's not how you're going to formulate it. By contrast, advocating for colorblindness in public and professional life is a winning issue. Cleaning up pollution is a winning issue. You may be against all kinds of regulations to prevent it, but you're not going to say, I think people ought to be allowed to pollute. If you ask me, gender equality is a winning issue in the Jewish world, across particularly all sectors of the community. Even people who are opposed to it have a difficult time defending gender inequality, defending the notion that, yes, it's perfectly right and acceptable to say a woman cannot do this, a man can do that, it matters what your gender is for what your place is on the pecking order. And in general, it will need to be shifted to the terms of different terms of discussion. Text, tradition, appeals to inscrutable divine commands. By contrast, gender blindness, the denial of any significance to biology and social ramifications, I would suggest is a losing issue. It is difficult to convince someone that a deeply held experience of difference is irrelevant and constructed, even if that is the case, and certainly if it is not entirely irrelevant and constructed. Put more broadly, in political terms perhaps, fighting discrimination is a winning issue, denying difference is a losing issue. And therefore, from both a tactical and substantive perspective, I think it is very important to detach the cause of gender equality from the cause of comprehensive gender blindness. Both may be worthy and important goals. I'm not suggesting being for one and against the other. When I say detach, I mean thinking of them as separate goals, separate discussions that interweave, clearly have all kinds of connections, as I suggested at the beginning, but that we ultimately have to find a way to articulate these as not entirely inextricably linked campaigns. Now, the last thing I want to say before we move to the text is there's another aspect to the challenge of thinking about this, which is our society has been moving and continues to move away from a simple heterosexual binary account of human gender and sexuality. And that queerification of our gender and sexual norms means that conventional solutions can no longer fully work or have the same meaning as they once did. So if a mechitza in a prayer space is meant at least in part to address issues that arise from heterosexual energy, how does and can it function in a world that has created space for legitimate and even celebrated relationships that don't conform to that paradigm? That's irrespective of the question of how one normatively tackles those issues. Once one's created a world in which we see and experience different things around us, some of the old paradigms and old solutions that we're seeing and responding to different things can't simply be carried over with the same meaning. And what I take from that is it reinforces for us how it is virtually impossible to come up with a single system that can address these issues of gender equality and gender blindness. And that leads me to my main argument, and this is what we're going to get into with the text now, which is we need to embrace multiplicity when it comes to this topic. We need a world with more possibilities on this front, not fewer. We need to find a way in which we can stay focused on how gender equality can never fully advance without a meaningful degree of gender blindness in the world. And we also need to find a way in which the diverse needs of the human population around issues of sexuality need not be negated in order to purchase gender equality. And we need to find a way to acknowledge and meet those needs without falling into the trap of perpetuating old hierarchies that are inappropriate and distorting in the present. So I want to now turn to the text that I think are going to hopefully help us do the three things I think we need to do in order to get there. First, we need an accounting within rabbinic language of the diversity of human experience when it comes to sexuality. How can we name and recognize that not all people are the same on this front? Second, we need an accounting of the changes in society over time. How can we actually explain to ourselves again in rabbinic and normative language that our world may actually look different from the world of the past and demand different kinds of responses? And third, I want to suggest that we need to flip our discourse on the topic of gender difference and sexual energy from one that is focused on hunting for pritzut, for licentiousness, to one of accommodating and responding to nizirut, the distinctive needs of individuals and subcommunities. I want to play each three of those out in turn. So let's go to the sources that you have here, and we're going to begin with the first task, which is how might we construct a discourse of divergent and varied human needs around this topic. So here we have a terrific story in the Talmud Bavli in Ketubot about Rav Acha. We're told that when Rav Acha was at a wedding, he used to take the bride on his shoulders and dance with her. Okay, it's quite a scene. His students, his colleagues, thought so too. They wanted to get into the action. They said, "Anan ma'ulam avad achi? Can we do that too?" And he says to them, if they are like a wooden beam to you, then fine. If not, no. Now, we can write a full dissertation around the not entirely unproblematic formulation here of the way it becomes acceptable to have this kind of physical action with this woman is to imagine her as an inert object, and there's a certain desexualization which may not be entirely healthy or you know, completely unproblematic. But I'm bracketing that for now, even though that's worthy of discussion. My main interest in this text is the fact that Rav Acha here, standing right there in one moment, we're not talking about over a span of time in different societies here, says, there are some things that are okay for me that may or may not be okay for you. And I don't know that. First, he acknowledges the variety, and then he also says, you're going to have to know that about yourself. You'll have to tell me. If you experience this as something that's really walking the line of sexual impropriety, then no, don't think I'm doing that just because it's a wedding, so I'm allowing myself this leniency. This is grounded in my experience and self-knowledge of, this is a benign platonic experience for me. To the extent you experience it that way as well, no problem. To the extent you don't, then no, it's completely unacceptable. This text actually has within it, there's a number of other texts we could select, but it's one very powerful manifestation in Chazal of an acknowledgement of not everyone's the same. The same arrangements, the same boundaries, the same prohibitions on behavior when it comes to issues here, clearly we're dealing with an undertone of sexuality, may not be the same. And this is picked up on and developed by the Ritva in 14th century Spain. He's commenting on a different passage in Kiddushin, which I could have brought you, which I didn't, but you'll see he'll come back to the Rav Acha text. The text there is talking about another questionable situation where a rabbi seems to be crossing some line, and his answer is Hakol L'Shem Shamayim. Everything is for the sake of heaven, meaning it all depends what a person's intention is. Okay? Everything depends on whether it is for the sake of heaven. And so the halacha, b'chein hilchata, says the Ritva, that everything follows a person's self-knowledge, right? Everything doesn't mean every mitzvah in the Torah. He's talking about various kinds of boundaries around contact. Here, mainly we're focusing on heterosexual contact across the sexes. If it is appropriate for a person to create barriers against the sexual drive, one should do so. But if one knows that one's sexual drive is under control and will generate no impropriety, then one may look at and speak with one who is sexually forbidden. And that is how Rav Ada Bar Ava used to take a bride on his shoulders and dance with her without fear of inappropriate sexual thoughts. Okay, we'll get to the last line in a second here. But what the Ritva says here is, this story is not just a story, it's meant to be paradigmatic of a general approach. What we learn from Rav Ada is not just the historical curiosity that Rav Ada used to dance with a bride on his shoulders, but Rav Ada, as a great sage, modeled for us the kind of discussion we're supposed to have about this, which ultimately throws the responsibility onto people to know themselves and to figure out how to self-regulate. Now, as soon as we start hearing about self-regulation, we get nervous, and the Ritva also got nervous and said, but only a very pious person who is self-aware regarding sexual temptation should be lenient in these matters. Not all scholars trusted themselves in this way. It's suggesting it'll be a rare bird indeed who can actually decide that I'm totally fine, I won't fall into this trap, I won't cross any lines. This is, of course, being formulated from the perspective of the man. We could formulate it even more on behalf, potentially, of the woman or the more vulnerable partner in these kinds of interactions, who is certainly not interested in the self-policing of the person who will potentially be crossing barriers and abusing them. So it's not that there's nothing problematic about this model, and the Ritva basically says we got to be very careful about how this is put into play, but still sort of leaves at root what we are trying to regulate here is an issue that is variable across the population, and that's going to have to be sort of taken into account when we think about how to manage this. So this is piece one. I'll just sort of pause here for a minute. Questions, comments, or thoughts on this? These initial texts are demonstrative, I'm arguing, of one piece that we need in order to kind of engage these issues today, which is to begin to build up a discourse that affirms the idea that not everyone is the same. There's not a blanket rule that's going to be appropriate for everyone. Incidentally, by the way, I will also note, we should not forget that Rav Acha's story also demonstrates that sometimes, at least in his estimation, going overboard in putting up too many fences may have other costs. You might say, well, why didn't he just say, well, since it's not good for everyone, no one should do it. But I think he recognized that in a certain way, that creates a different kind of problem where the bride's not riding on his shoulders. That is to say, whatever simcha he's able to bring to that interaction, that's something that is potentially lost. When I have been in settings, and sometimes this is played out, I would say, sometimes in context at Yeshivat Hadar, when I've been in settings where there is sort of a sense of some degree of, you're in a completely integrated environment in terms of, let's say, learning or an experience, but then there's skittishness at a moment of celebration at the end or at a peak moment as to whether it would be appropriate for people to join hands and dance, because there's a sense of, well, that's starting to cross a line, right? Something is lost if you don't dance. It might be the right thing to do. It might be the appropriate sexual boundary, halachic boundary, etc. But something is lost when a group of people who have shared something together don't just jump in all together and celebrate it as one. And we see some degree of recognition of that in Rav Acha, where he's feeling something will be lost in this wedding. If I don't jump in, maybe he had a special talent of how he carried the bride on his shoulders. Who knows? And he felt, as long as this is neutral and not an issue, that's actually the right thing for me to do. Okay, thoughts or comments on this before we move to part two? Please.
Simple question. Is it Rav Acha or Rav Acha?
It's one place.
It's different. Oh, because in the Ritva, yeah, it's good, yes, correct. I've got to go back and check the Kitvei Yad. He seems to have had a different girsa. We can see, obviously, how orthographically the Dalet and the Chet might have switched. Have to check it. Blew right past it. Thank you. Other, yes?
I'm just wondering that it seems like these texts could be read to be thinking about the men's motivations here and how impure thought would be bad for them. Or it could be that Rabatha is saying, if you have like an over-sexualization, that will be experienced like something unpleasant by the woman you're carrying. And I wonder whether you think it's definitively one or the other, or both, or...
I would love to say that second reading is in there. It's not the overall tone of rabbinic texts to care about such things, if we're honest. That is to say, that does not pour out organically of the texts that address these issues. But what I will say is this. I think it's very hard to know in a culture that talks about some things and doesn't talk about other things, whether implicitly some of those other things are encoded in some of the norms, right? I mean, a good example of that, I think, is a very strong case to be made that the laws of Yichud around not allowing segregation between men and women or people who are inappropriate matches for one another because of their relationship with one another, whatever it is, even though they are extrinsically about licentiousness, seem pretty clearly intrinsically to be a good deal about rape and the concern that someone will abuse. And that goes to the fact that even though they're all about the extrinsic possibility that people are going to get into trouble and get into a forbidden sexual act, they are tied back ultimately to the story of Amnon and Tamar in the Tanakh, which of course is a situation where because they were alone, the person with more power took advantage of the person with less power. So I don't rule out that your concern is sort of lurking there, but it would be sort of almost in the subconscious, swallowed up in another category. Okay, last point on this.
This was in the context of a wedding situation where there's a party, but what about healthcare workers who are in an entirely different situation? I mean, it's not a frivolous this thing. It's just part of the job.
Good. So when you get to the question of contact and all sorts of forms of contact, there's all kinds of texts we can talk about that and all kinds of discussions and starting in the medieval period and on as to whether in the context of a doctor-patient relationship and feeling a male doctor feeling a woman's pulse, whether, you know, the concerns that one generally might have around contact should apply. And you're saying in those kinds of situations, it should be even less of a problem. Part of what's striking about the Rav Acha text is exactly as you're implying, we're dealing with pretty intense physical contact in the context of a setting where normally we might be very concerned about boundaries being crossed, and nonetheless, there's a sense of, well, this doesn't affect me in the same way, and therefore it's okay. Again, the question of how generalizable is Rav Acha, how much does he represent the majority of the population, or how much is he a weird outlier, that's what the Ritva transmits some nervousness about. But again, my use and investment in this text is more that we shouldn't think that grappling with an uneven data set across the human population in terms of dealing with gender, sexuality in the world, that is a sort of foreign introduction into how Chazal and rabbinic sources would talk about this. That's actually a core part of not just the story in the Talmud, but what the Ritva says about v'chein hilchata. That's the halacha, and that's how these things have to be processed. All right, that's piece one. Let's move on to piece two. If that was about sort of horizontal variation across the human population in a given moment in time, we can then also ask the question of a certain kind of vertical variation across time. That is to say, can it be that actually entire societies move to a different place, right? And again, this is part of what I'm saying, I think, to the extent we want multiple strategies for dealing with questions of gender equality and gender blindness and how much they're linked. Part one here is intended to show, for some people, these issues might remain very real and sensitive, and gender blindness might be a major problem, even as the person sitting next to them sees gender blindness as the ideal and correct world to live in. And I want to sort of supplement that with the other side, where why it's plausible to potentially make an argument that, yes, our society and our world is different in meaningful ways that demand a different halachic response and should make us open also to gender-blind manifestations of gender equality. So this story begins, and this analysis and this work has really been developed at great length for those who are interested by Rabbi Yehuda Herzl Henkin, and for those who are interested in his book, Understanding Tzniut. He deals both with a lot of these sources and lays out a lot of the approach here, but I'm giving you a little tamtzit, a little summary of what I think is the best example. Sefer Chassidim, I didn't give you the dates here, but we're in 12th century Germany, this pietistic circles of Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid. This is a book that talks about all kinds of ways that people should behave properly, with many examples around sexual propriety and impropriety. And here he's dealing with a case of how one is to conduct oneself when asked to lead the zimun, to lead the grace after meals at a wedding, where the traditional formula calls for the addition of Nevarech Elokeinu Shehasimcha Bimono V'Sheachanu Mishalo. Let us bless the one who has joy in his abode. Right? Which you only say at that wedding meal. Someone who is saying that, in whose realm there is joy, must examine whether those assembled have fulfilled the requirement to rejoice with trembling. That is to say, Gilu Bir Adah, has this just been an untrammeled, unrestrained, wild party? Or has this been joy in the context of trying to be reverent people who are serving God through their joy? And he gives a number of ways in which this is manifested, including people are cursing at the tables, all kinds of things. But among the things is if women are sitting intermingled with men. Nashim yoshvot bein ha'anashim. Okay, it's a wedding with mixed seating. Says Sefer Chassidim, if women are sitting among men, hirurim sham, there is sexual impropriety there. One may not say this formula. Why? God is not happy, right? God is not happy in God's abode. Therefore, you cannot say shasimcha bimono. Right? That's the ruling of Sefer Hasidim. Not clear if everyone would have agreed with Sefer Hasidim, but it becomes a kind of accepted fixture, at least of Ashkenazi halacha, to think of that text as a guiding principle, and that certainly would be like your first go-to text for saying it's forbidden to have mixed seating at a wedding. The Levush, 16th century Poland, 400 years later, cites the Sefer Hasidim. You'll see he has a problem with the Sefer Hasidim, but notably, he does not say, well, we don't follow the Sefer Hasidim. He assumes this text to be binding. This is a text he feels accountable to, and yet he reports, no one's careful about this today. All the weddings in 16th century Poland, mixed seating. Okay, ein nizarim baze. Now he has to justify it. How can it be? Well, it might be because now murgalot anashim harbe bein anashim ve'en kan hirhurei avera kol kach. Women are very accustomed to be around men, such that there is not so much sexual impropriety. Now, that kol kach, that so much, is actually very important. I want to come back to that in a second. But what's his basic claim? The claim is the social reality on the ground today in 16th century Poland is different. Outside of the wedding hall, our world looks different from the world of the Sefer Hasidim. In the world of the Sefer Hasidim, men and women did not really mingle in public spaces that much. So he claims. I don't know if he has the history of we would match that up, but that doesn't matter. Levush's understanding of the world of the Sefer Hasidim is there was a kind of strict gender separation regime throughout life, such that then to have suddenly a mixed seating at the wedding is totally wildly inappropriate. However, says the Levush, that's not the world we live in. We have much more free interactions between men and women in all kinds of contexts, such that we have become used to it. Mitoch rov hergelan beinenu. There is not so much sexual impropriety on account of how often they, meaning the women, are in our, the men's, midst. And people got used to this. V'chivan didashu dashu. What was once an erotic interaction, or a potentially suggestive and inappropriate interaction, has now become something that we have become inured to. Something that's become simply run-of-the-mill and pedestrian. Now, the kol kach here is actually very important. Because the Levush is not saying there's no sexual energy present. He's saying it's at a level that you expect people to be able to deal. You expect it to be manageable. It's not at a level where it feels it is breaking down boundaries. It's the normal experience of people who are sexual beings being in the world and having to deal with that as part of an integrated part of their personality and their experience. But the world is different enough from that of the Sefer Hasidim that even an adherent, right, I want you to understand what the Levush is saying. The Levush is saying, if the Sefer Hasidim were here today in 16th century Poland, he wouldn't forbid mixed seating at a wedding. Because the issue was never mixed seating at a wedding. The issue was hirhur. The issue was an excessively unrestrained environment of inappropriate and uncontrolled sexual energy. Back in his world, that may have been what it was like. In our world, it no longer is. Right? So that Levush is a very strong and direct articulation of what it looks like to say one world may be different from another. I think even more powerful is the Bach's formulation, where he is not talking about the mixed seating, which we can presume from the Levush's description, which is in his day, he would have agreed that the weddings were all mixed seating if the Levush is telling the truth, but goes back to the Ravacha or Ravada Barava story of the Kala, the bride, on the shoulders. And he says the following, in our country, the practice is for scholars to be lenient with a bride, to carry her on her shoulders during a wedding. Meaning it was common in 16th century Poland for the Gedolim to do what Rav Acha did, pick up the bride and put her on their shoulders. This is like messing with your portraits of Eastern European Jewry. Okay, good. Well, welcome to studying halachic texts. But then he says, very important line, Veheicha de nahug, nahug, veheicha de lo nahug, isura ika. Wherever this is practiced, that's the practice and it's completely legitimate. But wherever it's not practiced, that is to say people have not become used to this, it is forbidden. Formulations here are very instructive. He doesn't say, wherever this is the practice, it's the practice. Wherever it's the practice, it's not the practice. There's a recognition here that what it means to take seriously, that conditions may change on the ground, is that conditions change on the ground. Which means, in a place where everyone always carried the bride on their shoulders, and you see that this is just a normal part of what happens in the context of this Jewish community, it's totally fine. In the context of a community where that was never done, that's going to be crossing a line that is totally inappropriate to cross, and therefore it is forbidden. Right? And this is a kind of nice blending of the vertical and the horizontal, sort of affirming we live in a different place than perhaps the Sefer Hasidim did in the past, and also the way that's playing out in our own environment is not the same. Right? So just to give you a sense, right, how you might translate this in all other kinds of contexts, you might say, yeah, in places where like people sit in a gender-blind fashion at a funeral, there's no problem. No one should raise any hackles about that. But in a place where that was never done, it's completely forbidden to come into that environment and say, no, no, sit together, there's no problem. Right? In that sense, it might be totally fine to be without a mechitza and completely forbidden to take down a mechitza. Right? That's sort of the formulation of the Bach. He's not talking here about tefillah, but I'm just talking about as a sort of framework of what it means to think this way and to take seriously different contexts. Yeah.
This is the way we do it. We don't do this.
Right.
We don't, there's no mingling, and so therefore we don't, you know, put the bride on our shoulders to do any of this kind of stuff. And 400 years later, he says, so the Lavouche says, oh, no, 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 but we're not careful about this because we mingle all the time. But someone somewhere
Good.
Had to cross the line. So somebody had to be a pioneer at one time between the 12th and 16th century and shocked everybody by doing this. And then they did it another time and another time until it became the norm. So there had to be a chad b'chalak change at some point in order for that to become the custom in the 16th century. So for him to say, well, this is the practice, it's okay, but for the Bach to say,
mm-hmm.
the practice is okay, and where it's not, it's forbidden, I don't buy it, because where it's not, it's forbidden, well, somebody in that society could break the norm at some point, and then it's going to not become. It's forbidden right now, but then it's, at some point, maybe it won't become forbidden.
Good. Okay, it's a fantastic question. I want to kind of affirm what you're saying, but then challenge the premise that's behind it. What you're essentially saying is, I don't buy the Bach having an outright prohibition, because I assume the Bach could only post facto give legitimacy to something he would have authorized ab initio. That didn't make any sense. The Bach could only, once there are facts on the ground, the Bach would only recognize something as legitimate that he would have permitted had someone asked his opinion coming to do it in the first place. That's the premise, which is to say, how can he say no, you're not allowed? Because the only way we got to the minhag of carrying the bride on the shoulder was presumably that someone at one point breached that. Now, by the way, in that case, I'm not sure that's true, because back in the classical text, the rabbi, unlike the Sefer Hasidim example, Rav Acha is carrying a bride on his shoulder. If anything, the first data point we have is that that's fine. Then he tells the rabbinic colleagues, I'm not sure you can do this as well. But the point is still taken, right? With the Sefer Hasidim, how can the Levush approve after the fact something that clearly was a breach? So what I want to challenge the premise is, I don't think it's true that we only give kind of halachic and normative weight to the consequences of decisions we would have approved of when they were first adopted. It actually, I think, is the case that a lot of times there are boundaries that are breached. Had we been there at the time, we would have said, you should not be breaching that boundary. But nonetheless, over time, it creates a new reality. I'll give you another example of this from a totally different...
Misunderstanding.
Okay, so explain.
Misunderstanding. Sorry. I'm not saying that that he will only approve something that hadn't he been asked before that was the norm, he would have also said it's okay. In other words... I'm not saying that because he's also the Rabbi is also saying where it's not done it's forbidden. So
what's the problem?
So presumably you're saying that presumably he would that I am assuming that he would have said this is okay a priori. It's objectively it's okay. So where they do it, it's okay. And where they don't do it, they shouldn't do it. No, I'm not. I mean, I'm not saying that because if he thinks objectively it's okay, then he should be telling these people where they don't do it. Excuse me, but this is objectively okay. You don't want to do it, it's your problem. But objectively speaking, according to the strict reading of the halakha, it's okay. I'm not saying that. I think that you're...
So tell me what your problem is then again. What's the difficulty?
No, my problem is that naniach that it's not okay. Okay, that a priori it's not okay. It's not an whatever it is. It's not an okay thing to do. Okay, but somebody breached it somewhere in this community and it became the accepted norm. And so everyone's like, that's okay because we do it. That's cracks on the ground, we do it. Okay, and so he's going to say, well, then it's okay, because they do it. But where they don't do it, it's a forbidden thing to do. But what I'm saying is, I don't think that he should say that. I don't think...
Because?
I don't think he should say that because I think that if he thinks whatever it is not okay to begin with, then he can't say to the people that just do it, he can't say, well, it's fine.
That's what I tried to say you were saying, what you just said at the end. So if I didn't, it's communicated right, I apologize. But I think you are grappling with a totally reasonable thing of how can we function, how can someone talk like this with awareness that it crosses over? And here I want to just sort of share, there are any number of examples where this is true, and part of it actually goes to the question of the language of objective and subjective. I think that's often helpful language to us where we think, oh, there's sort of like a way the halakha is supposed to be, and then there's, what kind of compromises you have with the reality. And here what I'm actually trying to argue comes out of these sources is there is no objective. Or, put more correctly, the objective is an assessment of reality, and therefore correctly responding to that reality. And to the extent the reality is variable, the normative response is variable, because the normative response is actually about responding to the reality. Now, the surprising fact here where someone comes along and says, basically breaches a boundary, but then in retrospect they create a reality that we essentially give some imprimatur to, though surprising, that happens in any number of places. I want to just give one other benign example. It is forbidden, according to the Talmud, to make bread with dairy, with milk or with butter. Okay, that is forbidden. You have to throw out the whole bread. Unless you make it marked, there's all kinds of debates of what the Talmud means when it says Kein Torah, but if you mark it in some way or it's some kind of shape, such that people look at it and they say, oh, that's obviously a dairy baked good, then it's okay. Okay? So I think it's the Maharit, someone says, there are these pastries that now are on sale, which don't really look that different from the parv pastries, but they're different enough that people know that they are dairy. And he says explicitly, even though the first person to bake those was in complete violation of rabbinic law, and should have thrown them out, and I would have told you it's forbidden to eat it. Now people know. And at the end of the day, the only thing this halakha cares about is whether people know if it's dairy or not. And therefore, I don't really care if it happened through a transgression once I'm past that moment, because it's not about policing people's behavior. It's about how I'm now supposed to respond to this reality. And that's what I want to argue to you, is how this area of halakha is also meant to function, which is to say, it doesn't matter if the first women to wear pants in the 1920s were breaching a gender norm. That might be true. That might have been unambiguously, to any posek who was asked, to be a violation on the law, of the laws on cross-dressing. It doesn't matter if that's the origin of it. Once you get to a reality where it's just simply not the case that pants are a gendered item of clothing in the same way they once were, you now respond to that reality. So we actually do this all the time. There's all kinds of examples of this. I'll just give you my last favorite example, which is sort of the most outrageous. The Talmud says it's completely forbidden for men to shave the hair on their body, like their armpits and their legs. Why? Because this is the way women deal with hair on their bodies, and it's an inappropriate crossing of the gender boundary. Okay? So someone then asks a Gaon, a Babylonian sage, right after the Talmudic period, what's the deal with this halakha? Is it really true? We can't shave our armpits, our legs. I mean, is that how it plays out? And the Gaon responds to him, we've been shaving our armpits and legs in Babylonia for 200 years. Okay? That's also messing with the norms of the Jewish past, okay? So he says that, and he says, because you must understand, the whole category is not about shaving armpits and legs. It's about what the Talmud says, which is, you are not supposed to, in various areas, wantonly cross what are otherwise clear boundaries between the sexes in terms of appearance, etc. In our world, that's no longer a boundary. Again, you can go back and say, who was the first person in the rabbinic academy to come in with a shaved armpit? But that's not the Gaon's concern. Right? He's past that point in time. Yeah?
I just want to raise a possibility. It says, Tucker said that maybe the first person was completely crossing gender boundaries, etc., etc. I want to say we're not even talking about an objective, or we could be talking actually about an objective isul. However, this text Dafka isn't talking about it. This is talking about a place where Talmidei Chachamim are the ones doing it. Therefore, clearly it's not completely wrong, or else Talmidei Chachamim would not be Nogim Lahakim, not Nogim Lahatir, Nogim Lahakim. There's a difference. And therefore, there is room to maneuver, and then we can move. We're not bringing it from completely asul to, okay, now we're talking about it, and then it'll move progressively as the generations go forward, etc., etc. We're not talking, it's not talking about Noagim Ezrachim to Lechol Chazir Bechalal or Mashu Kazeh.
Of course.
Noagim Talmidei Chachamim, who clearly know the text.
So two things. First of all, it's for sure about the Talmidei Chachamim, but note that it's forbidden even for the Talmidei Chachamim in the other place. That is to say, I'm not claiming that the Bach is talking about the entire population, but he's talking about whether a Rav Acha type figure is allowed to do what Rav Acha did in the Gemara. And there he says, in one context, where the Talmidei Chachamim nahagu to do this, it's perfectly fine. In other contexts, if some guy who's a Talmid Chacham in this town went to a wedding and saw them do that there, and he wants to come back and bring that minhag to this community, he can't do that, because that's completely, there's no context for that being normalized. So still the basic dynamic of saying this has a different context in different communities plays out. Yes, this particular halakha is about a specific subset that he's describing, but it's still saying even Talmidei Chachamim are forbidden in some places and permitted in others.
But it was never a mukhlak isul. It was never totally forbidden. Would it be possible at all in some sort of understanding of the text, according to Fakir, say eventually if somebody were somehow, this is obviously very radical, to say we can eat pig now, and he was crazy, but so, eventually if he can normalize.
Good. So hold on. So let's clarify, because that's the second point I want to make, which is very important. When you talk about eating pig, those are not isurim that have anything to do with responding to the social reality. This is a thing that's, I think, particularly sometimes discombobulating about discussions about gender and sexuality, which is to say, part of what I'm arguing is there are certain issues in halakha that intrinsically the value that is being discussed is a social reality. Then there are other mitzvot, the overwhelming majority of them, which are about some kind of stance or value that has nothing to do with the social reality, is sometimes even often countercultural. Shmirat Shabbat is dafka countercultural. You live in a world where Paro makes people work 7 days a week. You say, we don't do that. I don't care what the culture is, I'm working on Shabbat. Everyone's got to stop. Most mitzvot are like that. But there are mitzvot, or there are even here halachot, even we can call them more generally, and rabbinic guidelines, etc., that are about issues of kavod, hirhur, etc., etc., such that responding to the facts on the ground is what the halacha is about. And that's why I would say, when you say there wasn't a total isur, I would formulate it differently. I don't think it's a question of a total isur or a partial isur. It's a question of, is it a variably applying isur? To the extent, that's how I understand the Bach. That's what I think his language is saying, and it's mimicking Rav Ada in the Gemara. For the person for whom it's permitted, it's permitted. And for the person for whom it's forbidden, it's entirely forbidden. In other words, if the woman is like a wooden beam to you, he says, then no problem. But if she's not, you may not. Not because it's sort of a gray area, but because what this is about is, and again, this is what the Ritva tried to explain, it's about knowing who you are and thereby applying what's the mitzvah. The mitzvah is to distance oneself from erva. But there's a sort of acknowledgement and a realization here, I'm arguing, that both individuals are different on that front, and societies across time and space are not always the same. Rav Henkin gives a good articulation of this also. He's responding to the fact that the Ritva gets nervous about giving people individual discretion about how to act. Right? The Ritva says, I don't know, this whole Rav Acha thing, I can understand maybe Rav Acha could get away with it, but come on, you can't trust that so much. He says, in my opinion, the Ritva means to say that an individual may not be more lenient with himself than others, except in the case of a very pious person. But when something is widely practiced, then people can certainly rely on the idea that they will not get into sexual trouble by looking at others or engaging in other not essentially sexual activities, and then individuals can decide to be stringent as necessary. Meaning Rav Henkin is trying to say, the Ritva said an individual should not come along and say, the whole society has a boundary around this, but I think it's okay. Only outstanding Talmidei Chachamim should do that. But he says, but you have to pay attention to the Levush. The Levush had no problem saying, we can all sit at mixed seating at weddings and have no problem. And what's the difference, says Rav Henkin? One is a case, namely Rav Acha is a case, where the individual is saying, I can actually violate the social norm here and nothing will happen to me. And that's something that should be used very sparingly for an elite cadre of individuals. But the Levush is a case where he says the entire society now treats as very pedestrian a different kind of reality than the Sefer Hasidim had. And that has ramifications where then it's perfectly fine to say, okay, this is the new reality. Which again has nothing to do with halachot that are not about social reality, like kashrut and Shabbat and all sorts of other things, but halachot that are about responding to hirhurim, erva, whatever it is, those are meant to respond. Okay? Yes.
Both the rabbis came to the conclusion, if you can't see them, join them, and said, okay, bet it's in the and then how do we deal with that after that even though it has to do with social connect? And the second issue is, I think such a separation of halakha in this community is okay and allowed and they can do whatever, the other is absolutely forbidden, it deepens the separation between the communities and there are more sikhul halakha on those issues, in one community it will continue to become probably more lenient, egalitarian, mishulam, and in the other community it will become more permanent, more segregated. And then, what are we doing to have an end to the halakha?
So on the second point, look, whether, yeah, the second point that was raised was, doesn't having this sort of approach to these issues of different standards in different communities and the sort of multiple response to the multiple phenomenon in the world ultimately kind of separate and divide the Jewish people in some kind of meaningful way? So, look, on some level I would say to you, on all kinds of things, we do that all the time. Like, based on that kind of consideration, and there are some people who favor this, particularly in the context of kibbutz galuyot in Israel, we should be crushing the alternate nuschaot of the tefillah. And at the end of the day, people don't daven in exactly the same way, and they don't use the same words, and they don't have the same order of all kinds of things. And that creates certain barriers between communities. On that and all sorts of other things, we say, no, nara nara ufshate. Now, I understand there we don't say the other person's doing something forbidden on their own terms, but it is forbidden in many shuls, if the shul is Nusach Sfarad, to get up and daven from the Amud Nusach Ashkenaz.
Here we have, can we, in such a subject as this, have below Nimino Beit Mag and Beit Hillel
I think so. I think what you would have to say is, but they may, are you allowed, can you actually have a situation where the communities can still meaningfully blend in the way that Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel are said, nonetheless, to have somehow found a way to live together despite their great disputes? At the end of the day, I think all it means is if you go to a place where they don't carry the bride on your shoulders, don't carry the bride on your shoulders. In other words, there's a recognition that if you really understand, again, of course, if you want to have some sort of unity or discourse, everyone has to take seriously where everyone else is. If one side only sees Isur on the other side and the other side sees pluralism, then you're not going to have it work out. But the question is, as a model, I think that what the Bach imagines is that the people in the community that don't carry the bride on their shoulders don't necessarily think the other community is sinning. They just say, we don't do that. Our people aren't used to that. That would be totally inappropriate here. And therefore, you don't march into that place and do that. But you might say, I don't know what that is. That might be okay in that community. I'm not familiar with their norms.
Practically, does that happen? Or practically, do people fall back into
Well, that's a question. That I'm not sure I can answer you, how often people actually are able to embrace it. What I think you can see from a number of the poskim here is there is a willingness to embrace that in theory. The question of how much that will work, you know, I think the fact that we have a global world with people going back and forth cuts both ways. On the one hand, it means that communities are not sort of stable where they're at in the same way. On the other hand, it means everyone's sense of local minhag and practice is totally weakened. So there's a sort of sense of like, well, I grew up doing it this way, but then I also saw 17 things along the way, and I'm trying to figure out where I live in the middle. And that process, I think, is only getting kind of exacerbated in the contemporary world. That's an interesting sociological question, I think, of sort of where that goes. But part of what I'm arguing on the overall topic we're tackling tonight is if we want to find a way, which I think we should, to envision the conversations of gender equality as happening within a kind of rich matrix of possibility of how we deal with gender and sexuality more broadly, and have a more androgynous approach be one robust element of dealing with that, but not the only and necessarily dominant approach. Part of what that entails is cultivating a sense that different people need and respond to different things, and that actually if we want to succeed at that, to the extent it's hard for us, we have to work to cultivate within ourselves a kind of sensitivity and appreciation for that. In that sense, multiplicity is always hard. Right? It's always easier to think in a certain kind of black and white. The thing that's hard about it is it starts to crush the data of human life and human experience, and that becomes hard in a different kind of way. I want to just go to the last text here, so and then we'll have the last 15 minutes or so for discussion and question. Again, In part one, the story of the bride on the shoulders and the colleagues, the rabbinic colleagues who are not allowed to do it, even though Rav Acha, I find the kind of beginning of a reservoir of text that can speak to not everyone is the same. We have to take seriously the fact that things that may seem completely benign to us may be meaningfully problematic to others when we think about arrangements with respect to gender and sexuality in society. The second unit gives voice to the legitimacy of the idea that someone may experience their society as genuinely being in a different place than an earlier society or even than a neighboring society, and that potentially has halachic ramifications in terms of a more androgynous or inured approach or however we might talk about it. But then the third piece, which I said, is how can we nonetheless maintain a kind of respect for difference and a respect even for separation without falling into the trap of reinforcing old hierarchies and reinforcing old regimes that don't work. And here, as I said at the beginning, to me, what I think this switch has to be is from a language of pritzut to one of nizirut. A language of pritzut, the language of licentiousness, is a language that says, objectively, there's a kind of rampant sexuality in the world. If we apply this outside of the context of sexuality and talk just more broadly about gender and gender roles, we might say, objectively, there's a way gender roles are supposed to work in the world. And the job of, you know, change makers, the guardians of the law, the rabbinic leadership, etc., is to come down and to crack down on pritzut. And therefore, to see in all kinds of places where boundaries are being crossed, there's something problematic here, we have to crack down on it. That discourse, while very good for policing people, is generally terrible at allowing for any kind of meaningful multiplicity to people's approach to things. And it works in both directions. That is to say, if we take just the issue of the mechitza in prayer, that is a classic example where there is non-compromising ideology in spades on both sides. Which is to say, you have plenty of people who all they can see when they see a mixed prayer setting is pritzut. There's a kind of sexual impropriety. I can't believe those people are sitting in that configuration while they're davening. What is going on in that room? And you have people who see davening environments with a mechitza and say, what is the matter with those people that they need to put up a wall in order to focus and pray to God? Okay? To me, both of those are problematic. That is to say, we have another context on the mechitza. My main ideology around the mechitza, my main dogma around the mechitza is being non-dogmatic, which is to say, an actual approach to try and understand, well, what's going on for people? What are people experiencing? Demands a sort of more, a willingness to kind of be a little more humble and take in the data that we hear. And here, I think the model of nizirut is much more helpful. What is the nazir? The nazir in the Torah is someone who comes along and takes a liquid, a beverage, wine, which is benign to everyone else. Not just benign, a basic part of their functioning life of celebration, of sanctification, and suddenly comes along and says, that is forbidden to me on pain of violating the Torah. Okay? It's similar to, in some ways, the way vegetarianism functions in contemporary culture. Right? You come along and you just say, that's forbidden. Now, the response to that could be any number of things. Right? The Torah could respond to that and say, what's your problem? What are you, Meshuggah? Why are you doing that? Wine's not forbidden. You're not allowed to do that. Okay? That's not the Torah's response. The Torah's response is, you may need to do this. And actually, we take that so seriously that we say your commitment to taking on this restriction, which we don't expect of everyone else, actually has biblical force. Okay? Now, that's remarkable enough, the institution of the Nazir, the recognition that different people may need to bind themselves to different things. But more remarkable than that is Chazal's processing of the Nazir. Because Chazal come along in the Tosefta in Dmai and list a whole series of things that one is not allowed to do with respect to someone who took an oath. If a person is under oath not to eat bread and said, give me bread so I can eat it, one should not give it to him. For one does not feed someone something that is forbidden to him. Similarly, a Jew may not hand a Gentile a limb torn from a live animal, nor hand a glass of wine to a Nazarite, for one does not feed someone something that is forbidden to him. Now, what might have been a reasonable way of thinking about this? Great, you took that on, you live in your own world, which the Torah recognized as being binding in some way, but I'm not going into that bizarre situation. You ask me for a piece of bread, I'm going to hand you a piece of bread. It's a piece of bread. Why wouldn't I hand that to you? Right? You're a Nazir, you took some crazy oath not to drink wine? That's not my problem. You police yourself. You ask me for a glass of wine, I'm going to pass it to you. No, says the Tosefta. Tosefta actually says the individual needs that some people need to meet by taking on Nidarim, which might, strictly speaking, not be obligatory on them, but they've made them obligatory. If you're in relationship with them, they become your problem too. But it is formulated from a place of their particular and distinct need, not something that they are necessarily imperialistically claiming ought to apply to you as well. And that, to me, is sort of the hopeful ground for how you might talk about these issues in a more sensible way. What if we actually listen to how people describe themselves in terms of questions of gender blindness or lack thereof, the ways in which people talked about how the presence of gender in their lives was actually completely irrelevant, and every time it is brought up, it introduces all sorts of things that just seem to do nothing but institutionalize old hierarchies, and we said, that makes a lot of sense. Maybe you live in some sort of much more expanded version of the Lavouche's universe at weddings, where actually, this may actually not really play a role in your life. And maybe, according to the way these halachot are supposed to play out, maybe a lot of the divisions that I take for granted aren't really meant to play something real in your life, and I can accept that. And what if, by reverse, the person then who they are in dialogue with shares and says, actually, to tell you the truth, like, gender and my role as a man, as a woman, as however I'm defining myself is extremely important to me. And actually, when those categories are broken down, I experience all kinds of spiritual and experiential vertigo. And particularly in certain settings and in certain Jewish settings, that's a particularly intensely important piece to me. And we were able to respond and say, wow, I really hear that. Maybe for you that's actually a real issue. And maybe for me to demand that you deny that about yourself is like passing a cup of wine to a Nazir. But it takes out the sort of bite of one side enforcing on the other side and turns it instead into a real conversation of listening that is open in a deep way to multiplicity and to ultimately asserting that that's perhaps what these halachot are actually meant to do. Such that, similar to, as I suggested last week with the paradigm shift model, it's not about can we be lenient with putting down this wall and putting up that wall and this barrier and that lack of barrier, but we're actually trying to respond, as God and the Torah ask us to create a community, shelo yireh b'chirvat davar, that there not be inappropriate things in our community around these issues, but with the recognition that that's not going to be the same for every individual or for every time and place. Let's now open it up for a bunch of questions, and then we'll wrap. I'll do this in a round. Those who haven't gotten a chance, I'll take first. Yeah. Oh, and I'll also say, Nama, I don't know if you were able to sign around. Also, my colleague, Rav Avital Hochstein, who is also a teacher here and a longtime friend of Pardes, has just started a new weekly Dvar Torah that she's sending out. For those of you who are receiving it, great. But Nama just has a sign-up sheet for anyone who's interested in receiving that. You can put your name down, and really great, interesting insights on the Parsha each week. Yes, please.
I have a lot of questions. I'll just mention something that doesn't require comment, but a really good example of someone breaking down the gender barrier. I hope I'm remembering this correctly. It's Tevya in Fiddler on the Roof, and it's at the wedding, right? Where he says, I want to dance with my wife. And then I think he starts dancing with her, right?
Right.
And this is in a community where they're not used to that. So I just wanted to throw that out. Mm-hmm. A really good example of it. maybe that starts how that started.
Yes, maybe not part of the rabbinic canon, but definitely part of the Jewish canon, without question. Fantastic, thank you. Yeah.
It's interesting that you bring the example of a saying an oath, because the Torah doesn't seem to take certain people's perspectives very seriously, because about oaths in the Torah, it says that if a woman swears an oath, then her husband or her father can cancel it. So I'm sort of having trouble sort of integrating this whole thing as a premise that to respect people's nazirut, because the Torah itself doesn't seem to respect certain people's perspectives. So how do you resolve that?
Yeah, well, I think ultimately that's highly local. That is to say, a woman's oath can be canceled. A man's oath cannot be canceled by any other man. In that sense, it's a very specifically gendered halakha, and the only person who has the right to cancel her oath is either her father if she's unmarried or her husband if she is. And this text, rabbinic texts sign on to that and play out all kinds of rules around that in Masechet Nedarim. That's another gendered difference we could talk about vis-a-vis last week. But here the point is, outside of that, in the vast majority of relationships, basically all the relationships other than daughters and wives, another person is bound to take that as fully seriously. Now, they would say this about a woman's oath as well, because until such time as it's been annulled, it's real and it's on the books. But it doesn't matter, because the person who's being asked to pass it, I think this text would even say it about the woman's husband. If he hadn't annulled the oath, it's still a fully binding thing. So I wouldn't say it's that the Torah doesn't take the oath that seriously. It's that the Torah puts in escrow with certain male patriarchal figures the right to uproot female vows in certain contexts. But that's a different kind of power than weakening the overall power of the oath. Now, Chazal didn't love oaths for all kinds of other reasons, and they didn't think people should generally take them, but that was in part because of their fear of how serious they were. So I actually think it's quite in tune with their thinking here, but again, it's the sort of vicarious responsibility piece here that I think is so kind of compelling and interesting. Yes, please.
Considering of what all the storm and drama that's going on with the women of the wall and the revolution, and who can force what, and what force was to create a cultural revolution, it's very important to think about the culture of the time and place, because in this particular photograph, the men and women have the photograph, on the pizza, get to yourself. Self-enforced. No opportunity, nobody coming there to make a point. That's just the way it is.
Yeah, look, obviously with that you have all kinds of other political things of originally what did the Ottomans allow and then what would the British have allowed, and in some contexts someone might have wanted to put up a barrier but they wouldn't have let them anyway, so it's hard to know fully what would have happened, but there's no question that, yeah, different things happen in different contexts. The question, I think, is there's two ways we can respond to facts like that. You know, you can point to a scene like that and say, see, the whole issue doesn't matter. Or you can say, this has taught me another datum. I see that in this context, with these people, etc., forget, let's even assume it was done with rabbinic approval, which I'm not sure we can, right? But in that context, it was processed in one way, and in another context, it's processed another way, and to actually sort of deepen one's respect for the sort of variety of possibility. And that's what I'm pushing for. I'm very wary of any reading of the data that has its preferred lens of human experience that it then shoehorns everyone else's experience into. I think the only way out is some degree of sort of a broader perspective. Yeah.
Response to
talking especially about these issues of what, you know, when you become nearer to somebody, whatever. Obviously, in modern society, that's a huge issue. The whole issue of feminism, gay rights, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And how that influences Jewish practice.
I don't see how it can't. I don't see how it can't influence it. Now, that doesn't mean you can't be countercultural. Right? Again, a person can come along and say, the general society is doing X, Y, and Z, and it's wrong, and I don't want to be desensitized to all sorts of things, and therefore, I'm going to wall myself off from it. Right? That is to say, so part of the answer to your question will be, well, how much has the relevant Jewish society actually integrated into those norms or not? To the extent there's some Gentile culture on the other side of the street where things go on, but I have really separated myself from it such that I'm not, I see it and I know it, but it hasn't really seeped in, then it doesn't really matter.
Well, we know for an obvious issue of feminism, hope, you know, this is discussed even in Holocaust, that a woman can be a neurosurgeon and a woman can be president of the United States, God willing. But she can't be president of the show, or she can't, you know, any of the other things. Like, there's such cognitive distance between society at large and Jewish society that how could you not argue that the non-Jewish society has overwhelmingly conditioned, you know, everybody, including Jews, to feel a certain way. And yet, there are the people who are walling themselves off and saying, no, that's not, that's just what happened.
Well, I think the honest truth is you've seen a kind of spectral approach to that in the Jewish community in modernity, right? I mean, but in the United States, the vast majority of American Jewry doesn't have cognitive dissonance on this issue, meaning the vast majority of American Jewry, of course, would have a woman as the president of the shul, which includes not just the conservative reform and reconstructionist movements, but any number of Orthodox synagogues also. And then there's some who are saying, no, we want the synagogue to be different and to hark back to certain kinds of models of leadership that we've inherited, and then you have others who are more aggressively countercultural. That's part of the moment. But going back to your question, I think the real issue is how much are those norms actually being sort of embraced? In other words, what I do think the plain sense of the Lavush, I think when he says, like, we are around women more, I don't think that just means Jewish women. I think there's some sense of the way we function in the cities and in the markets, etc. We're less walled off from this. And implicitly, we don't think it's the worst thing in the world. We're not waging a countercultural battle against it. Now, sometimes, I think two things here. Sometimes we do and should wage a countercultural battle, right? It used to be, it's funny, like still maybe like even 3 years ago, I could say like, I don't have a television and that would be significant. Now that's finished, right? That has like no meaning whatsoever. Like part of not having a television was like, I don't want that crap in my house, right? I don't want someone deciding that they're going to transmit this thing, right? I want to be able to decide when I'm going to waste time, right, on my computer, right? In any event, there's an aspect there of part of a sensitive mitzvah observant life is being countercultural to things in a broader society that are not okay. The other thing which I think is tricky, and this goes on some level to how much is constructed, right? We can get used to a lot of things in our society, right? I mean, one of the most, I'm not getting into a kind of political comment or endorsement here. I'm just making a cultural comment, right? The crassness of this election cycle in the United States has been mind-blowing, simply mind-blowing. But one of the things that's the most mind-blowing about it is you actually feel what it is to get to a place where you become ostensibly inured to something. Like someone says vulgar things so many times that it actually doesn't shock you anymore, but it still shocks you. That is to say, there are limits. You sort of feel that it's not as if we could just throw, I think, yes, it's not as if we could throw out all norms on clothing, on language, et cetera, and get to a place where it would turn out nothing would matter. In other words, the fact that the levush, and Rav Henkin tries to explore this line, I think, in a very helpful way. Right? Rav Henkin, I'm not sure it's the exact line, but he tries to divide between activities that are intrinsically innocent, but may have, in certain contexts, have had a certain sexual energy attached to them, those can become neutral over time. So, for instance, he'll say, sitting mixed at a wedding, there's nothing intrinsically sexualizing about that. It just might be in a society where men and women are not used to mingling. As opposed to, he'll say, right, there's certain kinds of dancing that are explicitly actually about being sexualized. Now, I don't know if that's exactly right or true, or if where he would draw the line is where I or you or anyone else would draw the line, but he's grappling towards something thereof. Is there a wall that one hits at a certain point where actually you can acculturate all you want, but you hit some point where actually things are still sort of shocking or breaching boundaries? I don't know, right? I think one of the unsettling things about our society is not being sure where that line is. And it's our uncertainty about that line that then makes some, at least, question, well, I don't know what to do with this issue at all. And part of the plea or sort of, you know, direction I'm making tonight is just because we have all kinds of deep questions about issues of gender blindness or the right way to manage gender and sexuality as a category of difference in society should not force our hand to therefore be equally nervous or unsettled around the question and issue of gender equality. Both of those are issues that our society is processing and we need to process, but I think there's actually much to be gained of being focused on the ways in which they for sure overlap, but are also not entirely congruent. I'm going to give you the last word.
What if it's not the piece of bread that we have to keep away, but it's your voice that is attracted to me and that's what keeps me quiet? And I think I would feel much more comfortable educating you to control yourself. And I don't need to be concerned about what I believe to be normative behavior, how it can affect you. Because I'm quite worried. I don't actually fully understand how it's going to play out in reality, what you're suggesting. And I'm less worried about exposing and mentioning to me. What about in a mixed gender space where people come in and they think, you know what, I don't want to have women as a fabrica. I can't learn with women. And how much do we need to say, this is where you are, you know, suck it up and learn to control yourself? And how much are we going to cater to everyone's whim about these issues that really could, you know, force others to have to make themselves smaller or hold back?
Yeah. So first of all, that's exactly what I'm trying to get at with the shift from pritzut to nizirut. A pritzut, a licentiousness frame, says a woman's voice up at the amud may have certain sexual qualities that are going to be problematic for men in our community. Therefore, we can't have women lead davening. A nizirut voice says, a man who experiences that, it may not be the right shul for him to daven in if a woman is leading musaf. But it has nothing to do with imperialistically sort of foisting that personal nizirut onto the pritzut enforcement squad of the community, and particularly the women who are going to often be the on the receiving end of that. I want to also add, because I want to go back to what I said at the beginning, which goes to the question of differentiation against the backdrop of inequality will always reinforce that inequality. And therefore, on some level, this is why this is talk two and not talk one. I only feel that we can begin to actually talk in this way if we've seriously mapped out in some way a vision of what it means to think about equality. And I would rather do it in that order I would rather have a vision of equality and then begin to think, how do we deal with difference, than to say, we can't get to equality until we've figured out how to either deal with this or tiptoe around it or crush the people who have a different experience. And what I would say to you about like the Chavruta issue, what it means to say, or, you know, suck it up, this is the environment where you are, etc. So, look, two things I would say about that. One is, things that are real, you can't fully make go away, right? It's for the Star Wars fans, if you strike me down, it will only make me stronger, right? That is to say, to the extent someone has a real, indelible issue with learning with a chavruta of the opposite sex, to take your example, then that chavruta is probably not going to work. No matter what you say, no matter what the policy is, it probably won't work. Now, a teacher and a mentor can sometimes know, with a person they're guiding and counseling, whether this is just something, and this, I think, is the importance of teachers and mentors, is this something like, a person's just not used to, but it'll be okay? Or is this something where it's not going to work, right? In other words, anyone who's ever led a hike with a group, there's a difference between people who say, I'm really scared to go down the handholds on the Arbel, but it's fine. You talk them through it and it's fine. And then people who actually really need to turn back. Like, they're acrophobic. They're actually going to go into a full-fledged bodily shutdown. Now, we can say, someone who feels, that's why I said it earlier, someone who really feels that all the issues around, you know, gender in a given area, it could be in davening, it could be in a chavruta, it could be in a number of things, are all a little bit of mishagas, I understand that. And such a person will be inclined to counsel that person to get over it. But to the extent that, and I said, this is where I feel like I have come to, I don't feel I can explain away the data entirely of people for whom it just actually can't be totally explained away. And then the question is, how do we acknowledge that, and we're taking one particular heterosexual example of a chavruta situation, right? But you could do any number of, you know, permutations on this. As people have a very hard time with all the same gender groups, it drags up all sorts of things for them. I think we can try to say that's all constructed and needs to go away. Or we can say we have to be thoughtful about this. There are times where people can be encouraged to just take the handhold slowly and get there. And then there's sometimes where people are acrophobic, and actually the right thing to do is not to cancel the hike, but to figure out how maybe there's more than one hike that's offered, including for people. I mean, this is what our society is increasingly being invited to do around disability, around all sorts of different needs that people have, where the question is, how does one create a community where people are together, where people are encouraged to stretch themselves, but also not encouraged to go completely against their own capabilities and limitations? Again, I think that I don't feel comfortable engaging in that without some background assumption of how one heads to equality and without a shift from pritzut to nizirut. But it's precisely because I don't think ignoring it ends up working that I want, you hear me searching for a way to try to think about what does that egalitarianism without a necessary corollary of total androgyny potentially look like. But I, like you, do not have all the answers on this, and I really appreciate the opportunity to share the thoughts and to learn together, and thank you very much.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.